Welcome to Frontlines Podcast, where I'll be chatting to social workers and sector experts about the key topics impacting them and the children and families they support. We'll also share reflections and actionable takeaways along the way, so you can continue to learn from other professionals to do your best work with children and families. My name is Hannah, and I work at the social work charity Frontline as a principal practice tutor. Since qualifying as a social worker, I've worked both in the voluntary and statutory sectors in multiple settings, including hospitals, criminal justice social work, and child protection teams. For me, social work should be about social justice, and I'm constantly finding inspiration from fellow social workers, service users, experts by experience, and community activists. This is one of the reasons why I'm very excited to be facilitating discussion on this podcast. In this episode, I talked to four guests about the idea of sparking change in social work. And what we mean by that is how all social workers at all levels can make meaningful changes in their role or team within their local authority in order to best support children and families. Often when we talk about change being needed in the social work sector, it can feel too large to take on an individual basis. In this discussion, we focus instead on the smaller but still significant changes that social workers have implemented, which have had real impact on teams and of course on children and families. We hope that this can provide some motivation and practical tips for how you could do the same. First up, I spoke to Paul O'Shea. Paul is a social worker working with the Family Group Conferences team in Enfield. Before qualifying in 2016, Paul's career was in education as both a teacher and college principal.
In terms of innovation, be ready to prove that it's making a difference if you're given the opportunity to follow it through, you know?
I started our conversation by asking Paul what innovation meant to him.
Well, first of all, I'd make the point, I think all social workers work in a unique, autonomous way. I mean, we all work within procedures that we have to be compliant with that are fixed, but there seems to be enough space within those procedures for us to have our own kind of unique approach to talking to young people, talking to families under pressure, trying to promote change in those families, in those young people, and assess risk at the same time. And I think innovation is when, as a social worker, you begin to sense that this particular approach I've got to conversation or to direct work with a child or to trying to get a family to function differently seems to work with different families and different people. And if I become convinced as an individual social worker that this particular approach I've got is working in different families with different people, then I would want to see if it could be replicated with other social workers, with other families, with other young people. And if I begin to sense that this particular approach works in different contexts on a kind of replicable basis, then I think I'm into something that's innovative and would be worth talking about and spreading around an organisation.
And why is this so important in social work?
Well, first of all, it's a bit of an obvious thing to say, but the social context of social work changes all the time, which means it seems to me what social workers do needs to change as society changes. So an obvious example of that would be, you know, the recognition in the last 5 to 6 years, I suppose, that a lot of risk for young people, young adolescents, doesn't sit necessarily within families, but within the communities that they're inhabiting and functioning within. So we begin to talk about contextual safeguarding and how we look to mobilise a kind of collective community response to those risks through better multi-agency working. More social workers are having to face the unique challenges faced by young asylum seekers or young people that have come with or without parents from war zones. And that requires different types of conversation, different types of insights. So the context in which social work is taking place changes all the time. Therefore, it needs to be open to innovation. Secondly, high escalation social work is expensive. Court proceedings are expensive. Obviously, putting kids in care is expensive. So you'd hope you'd be working in a profession where people might be interested in preventative social work that's innovative at the early point of intervention, because ultimately that should be saving us public resource, public money. I think thirdly, I would say it's been my experience, the local authority I work, and I know it's true across the country, that staff retention and staff turnover is a kind of fairly endemic organisational challenge in social care teams. And it seems to me that if you're working in local authorities or teams where innovation is encouraged, management is interested in refreshing ways of doing things, would encourage social workers to look at pilot projects, you know, run with their own particular approaches, you're more likely to stay in those kind of authorities where you think your ideas are valued, given some space, given some opportunity to develop. You know, retention, it seems to me, isn't all about paying people more or reducing caseloads. Important as those things are, it's about feeling that I'm working in an organisation where people are really interested in my particular approach and my particular ideas. So I think those are my three kind of considerations as to why we have to continue to be innovative as a profession.
Yeah, we work in society. Society's changing. There's a solid economic reason for being innovative, and it makes it an enjoyable, creative place to work.
Absolutely. And I mean, I don't think social workers come into social work just to be compliant with procedures. People understand the importance of procedures, don't get me wrong. But within that framework, you've got lots of scope to be creative, innovative as a social worker. And you'd be disappointed, it seems to me, as a new social worker, if you didn't feel that your employer or your authority wasn't respectful of, you know, your wish to be creative, innovative and make a difference.
It sounds like you have been lucky enough to have an employer that's enabled you to innovate. And with that in mind, what have you seen either in your own practice or witnessing other people's in relation to innovation, small, big?
I mean, the area that I'm particularly involved in, and I'll be modest about it because it's not, I've shifted from frontline, you know, just mainstream child protection social work to just running family group conferences now in a new in-house family group conference service that my authority Enfield have been wise enough to commit to, and saying, you know what, we're going to dedicate some of our own staff to doing this work, was an innovation. And it's worked. It's worked. We must have increased the number of family group conferences being used by about four within the first year. I mean, it massively increased because you were working to fellow professionals you already had relationships with. The whole referral communication procedures were much more streamlined. We had access to, you know, the case recording files. So social workers could see the work we were doing in preparation for the family meeting. You could align the concerns and the conversations you were having with what the social worker was doing. And you could foreground the authority of the family plan itself against the existing child in need plan or child protection plan to say, look, this is an important plan. These are important commitments. And the social worker can give as much attention to the family plan as they could to, you know, the existing professional plans, for want of a better term. I think all of those kind of positive outcomes were more likely if you had an in-house service. Or the point I'd want to make about why I think it's all been a success is that people involved in running the in-house family group conference service, there's only three of us, one full-time, two part-time. We've tracked data and feedback from day one. So we've taken on the responsibility of demonstrating to the wider authority, the wider team, that, look, this is working. But I mean, I think the point I would want to make is that in terms of innovation, be ready to prove that it's making a difference if you're given the opportunity to follow it through.
I'm just thinking, you know, as a newer social worker, I remember working with family group conferences and having some of the same thoughts you did, that this was an untapped resource, that often would just come in as a kind of last resort when we were worried about, you know, looking for alternative carers rather than an intervention in itself. But I don't think I would have had the confidence to go ahead and put forward a different idea. And then I'm also thinking about when I'd then been in practice for 5-8 years, at that point, there might have been an element of institutional, you know, I did what I did and that's how I did it. And then it held me back in putting ideas forward, but in a different way. So how do we overcome those barriers for both newer social workers and more established social workers, do you think, Paul?
Well, first of all, I think find your little group, you know, find your peer group. So for me, I mean, you've articulated actually not exactly a frustration, but a battle I think I'm still having, which is, when do we call family group conferences? So we've still got a lot of people calling family group conferences when we need to find alternative long-term carers or special guardians. And if we got this family together 12 months ago, we might not have reached the point of having to look at different songs. So that's just to endorse your point, first of all. So how do we get earlier family group conferences? Okay, well, for me, I'd want to find one or two social workers where I knew that we had a good family plan that really worked in a preventative fashion, and kind of get them to say, why do you think it happened? Are you prepared? Could you talk to this social worker about why it went well, and build up a little bit of confidence in yourself, that because other people are endorsing your instinct or your judgment, you're more confident about articulating it to others. Start doing your data analysis as soon as you start doing it, even without senior management approval. You know, try and build up a little bit of proof, a bit of evidence that it's making a difference. That when we call family group conferences for children in need, it looks from these 10 we've done that none of them got escalated to child protection. Okay. And I think once you start building that evidence base, then managers will start to want to listen to you. Actually, and this is my last little point, write a little paper about it. Look as though you're taking your innovation seriously enough to write two or three sides of A4 about these are the principles, this is why we went for it, this is what the evidence base we've got so far, how could we take this further? And, you know, literally dump it in their lap to react to.
It's acting without permission is what I'm hearing. Sometimes we can be institutionalised in our local authorities, but actually, right, if you've got a good idea, if you can speak the language, just go for it and then see what people have to say later. I like that. I'm really curious to hear your ideas on this. It sounds like you've got a real niche there in family group conferences. But if you had all the time, if you had all the resources, what other ideas do you have? What other innovations?
I haven't thought this, I feel passionately about it, but I haven't thought this through carefully enough to articulate it that coherently. But it would be something about open note-taking in the way we record interventions. I think we are clogged with templates and frameworks. I can see are well-intentioned because they're trying to keep social workers attentive to everything that they need to think about when they talk to a young person or visit a family or whatever. But sometimes I think, look, let us write in our own way about what we see, what we hear, what we think it means, and where it takes us to the next visit or, you know, or the next assessment. So I'd be, as I say, absolutely passionate to get involved in something about, it's just a Paul O'Shea phrase this, but I'm sure it's replicated, you know, kind of open text recording systems as opposed to recording systems that it seems to me are clogged in template frameworks that just create frustration. You know, someone might go away and think, you know, I'm already thinking, yeah, well, maybe I should push something about open text in Enfield, you know. So, just from this chat. So thank you.
Speaking to Paul, it's clear that social work needs to change as society changes. I loved how Paul spoke about starting with an idea, but doing that with data in mind, gathering your evidence so that you have a strong case to put forward to higher ups in local authorities. Next, I spoke to Priti Enwakane.
In some small ways, small steps, every social worker is a leader, and they do come up with ideas, they do come up with suggestions.
Priti is a service manager at Hertfordshire County Council who implemented the Hertfordshire Family Safeguarding Model, which has now been adopted by other local authorities. Priti was awarded an MBE for her work in supporting children during the pandemic. We spoke about why she champions innovation and why it's important in social work leadership.
I think what comes to mind, innovation, I think the word innovation itself is self-explanatory. So it's about coming up with some innovative ideas. And in my line of work, it's thinking about those in the way that we are working with families. And for me, an innovative work should be something that I think would contribute positively into social work practice and into the outcomes for children. So I do that because I feel that as social workers, we are almost like artistic. We need to get better all the time, and we need to see things, have a vision and go for it. And then you do that. So you come up with a vision, you plan it, and then you think about how you are going to execute it to bring about that innovative idea.
So as service manager, how are you embedding new ways of working and encouraging innovative thinking in your service?
I think I can respond to that by really referring to some of the projects that I have done and I'm involved with here in Hertfordshire. I think one of which, if you don't mind, is the Frontline Project, which started about 5 years ago here in Hertfordshire. And I was one of the main senior leaders to put that into practice. And I remember having a first meeting with some frontline leaders and some CSWs that we had recruited in Hertfordshire. And I think everyone was worried about how this is going to work. It's new to Hertfordshire. And I remember me saying, let's not overthink this. Let's go into it. Let's see what this is about. Let's put our heads together and plan it. And I can actually proudly say that even for the very first year, it was a very successful project. We even had to host some senior leaders from number 10 because of how we had managed it in Hertfordshire. I can also talk about family safeguarding, which is the main model that we are using for child protection here in Hertfordshire. And this one started about 2014. It was an innovative project by one of our senior leaders, but my role as a service manager was to implement it in my service area, which during the first evaluation, we had very positive outcomes. The MI project was something like, we are starting from nowhere. We did not have a blueprint. So I had that responsibility to say, in my service, I'm going to sell this idea. It's a good project. It's about changing social work practice, especially doing child protection, child in need. How do we engage families? How do we engage children? How do we provide a better service by working together in partnership with the families and all other professionals? And I think I up to now, this is a really very, very good project. And you may know that nationally, it's a project that's being, I think the government is encouraging other local authorities to kind of learn from that and use the program within their respective local authorities. So I think for me, that is one big innovative project that I've been involved with.
It's really interesting for me to think about the inception, because that seems so much of the sort of blueprint of how Hertfordshire operate, but how you got it from kind of idea to implementation. Can you say just a little bit more about how you think these two innovations link directly to the lives of children and families in improving those?
I think before I actually answer that, I do want to say an expression that was said to us by Professor Forrester, who was one of the, I think, authorities that did the evaluation of family safeguarding. He actually referred to us building the bridge as we were crossing or walking on it, which was quite good because we had nothing to start from. So for me as a leader, making sure that this project is going to be successful, I had to believe in it, which I did. And there was no training. Staff did not think that they had skills, but they did have skills that we could transfer. All skills were transferable. So we had to think about training. We had to think about how we are bringing in different professionals from different disciplines together and sitting around the table, all professionals having anxieties. And it was my role to make sure that I manage that at the same time, deliver the service. So how successful that has been to children, I think we can look at it from the point of view that internally, we look at stats, we look at children who are returning to us after having gone through the program. We're looking at the stats in terms of children on the protection plan or children or, you know, on the child in need. You may have heard that, you know, here in Hertfordshire, the numbers have gone down for children on the child protection plan. And that actually is a good indicator about how well the program is working. We have a system where we get feedback from service users, and we still have to be where there are safeguarding issues. They do have to be addressed, but they can be done in a way that whilst the family may identify certain areas of needs, as professionals going in, we also have to be able to identify, but the way we work with them, we work collaboratively so that we come together and we say, this is what has been identified. So what can we do to work with you to make things better for the children in the family?
What would you encourage social workers, Priti, within your service to do if they have creative new ways of doing things? How can they implement ideas and influence the right people?
I think I would draw back to, in particular, this family safeguarding. I think the leader who actually came up with the idea and how she sold the idea to us and to the service and actually making us believe in it and be able to actually buy into it was very, very good. I think I was very much impressed by her that she actually came up with this idea. She had that vision and said, right, this is how we're going to do it. And how I'm going to encourage the social workers that I'm working with, I think I actually will always refer. That's my reference point. About how that leader came up with the idea and came to us and actually sometimes would even look you into the eyes and say, challenge you that I can see that you don't believe in that. Do you want me to explain that? And then I think that's what I would do. I would really call upon workers and they have to believe in themselves as well, that if they come up with an idea, how is it that they think they can execute that? I do it anyway because in some small ways, small steps, every social worker is a leader and they do come up with ideas. They do come up with suggestions. And actually, I can even say even students, not just within Frontline, but students that we receive that come on placement with us, they bring such valuable experience. They bring such valuable ideas that we have to work with them, even if it's about coming up with a tool about how to engage with a child. I remember a social worker came up with a tool about how to do their last visit to a child when they are closing a case. And actually, it was such a fantastic idea. And I took it up to some of my senior leaders and I said, this worker has come up with this. And actually, it was accepted and shared across to other professionals so that they can use it. So in small steps, I think every social worker has some ideas. They've got some good ideas. It's about sitting down with them and then thinking about how do they think it's going to work. Most importantly, how is it going to impact on the children and their families?
And there's something there about, as a leader, you need vision, you need self-belief, but you also need humility. You need to know, actually, these people who are students, who are social workers, have amazing ideas too, and how can I be a facilitator? Mm-hmm.
I think it is very, very important because if anyone would start to think that they know it all, because what you do then, the people that you lead may begin to kind of like pull away from you. But if they know that you respect them, you respect their ideas. And by respecting their ideas doesn't mean that every idea that comes, they bring up, you have to go along with it. But actually, you have to show some curiosity and find out how they think that they can execute that. How can they implement that? And I think when they know that you trust them, you believe them, then I think they will also trust you when you go to them with some ideas. And I think you can bring them along. I believe in working well with my colleagues, with my seniors, but also the people that we lead. I think it's so very important.
And I can attest, as someone who supports people who you supervise, that that's absolutely reflected in how they talk about you as a leader and supervisor, Priti. Just a little bit more detail I think would be helpful about implementation from innovation. So can you give a little more detail about what you had to do in order to implement either the Frontline program or family safeguarding model? What was needed? Culture, training, right people in the right roles?
Okay, I think Frontline, I had to understand it myself as much as I could so that I can go, because it's a different way of working or training students. And so it was about going back to the established teams, because we rely upon them a lot, because these students are coming in, the participants are coming in to learn, and they are learning whilst they are practicing. So it was about working with the team managers, working with other service managers, working with the senior leaders to say, this is frontline, this is how it works, but this is what will be required for the students to be successful, and this is how it's going to benefit Hertfordshire. And so I can actually say that within Hertfordshire, frontline is very well accepted, it's very well respected. I think teams that are receiving students from frontline, they talk so positively about them, because they are receiving a candidate who has been trained on the job, a candidate who already knows the systems in Hertfordshire, a candidate who has already been out there, knocked at the door, chaired the meetings, been assessed, been observed on how they're engaging with families. So that can be only a good thing. So in regards to the family safeguarding model, we had to know that it's the MI approach that we were going to use, and actually recognize that the social workers are not trained in that. So it was about thinking about training, putting training first. But another thing that we had to work on was about bringing different disciplines together. We were bringing, you know, professionals from probation, we were bringing professionals from mental health, from CAMHS, from, you know, children's services, and from all over, really. And we all came with our own beliefs about our own profession. And sometimes we can be protective over our profession. But actually, it was amazing when we got together and you listen to what a probation officer does, you listen to what a domestic abuse officer does, you listen to what a health professional does. And we came to the conclusion that we are all working towards the welfare of a child. So everyone who came on board, is that they took that from that. And so we worked very well together. And I can say it's still going strong. I'm saying it started in 2014, it's still going strong. And also, I think what I also learned from the leader who initiated this was, and I referred to it earlier on as well, was to almost give like an open book to professionals that this is a new system. We've got these systems in place. You are the ones that are using the tools. But actually tell us if the tools are working, if the tools are effective, how user-friendly are they? And if you don't think they are user-friendly, you've got other ideas of how we can use them, come to us and we're going to look. And that is actually what happened. People say, actually, yeah, no, the workbook is very good. But in some ways, maybe could we add that, or could we move that, could we do that? That is what kept us going, because we were listening to people who are actually doing the job and using the tools.
Talking to Priti was an important reminder that you can't make change happen alone, and a reminder to always be curious about other people's ideas. Next up, I spoke to Ryan Wise.
I think one of our key learning points has been the roles and responsibilities in making small changes.
Ryan is a practice tutor at Frontline, having qualified as a social worker 7 years ago. He's currently co-leading the project Crescendo, which is supported by the Frontline Fellowship. I spoke to Ryan about how his project helps local authorities reimagine their children's services to increase the time being spent with children and families.
So we have one fundamental mission, and that's ultimately to increase the amount of time that practitioners spend with children and families. But when it comes to changing this, what we see is that nothing really happens sometimes because it's too big an issue. So kind of as you said, that these big, massive, wholescale changes just seem completely overwhelming. So what we found is that either nothing's done, or we might have wholescale big changes where from the top down, where we might have a new practice model, where we look to signs of safety or systemic family therapy to kind of shine a light on where we need to go, which obviously can have a positive impact. But for us, it doesn't get to the crux of the issue, which is like, how are we practicing social work and how are we enabling social workers to spend more time with children and families? So in terms of changing that, we sit in the middle between no change and full system change. So it's that gap that we try and navigate. So we develop this small changes approach. And what we mean by this is that you break down those big barriers that get in the way of practitioners doing their best work and spending more time with families. So just to give you some examples, when we theme barriers with the teams that we work with, what we hear is that there's duplication in the system. So we repeat all these forms that we don't need, or there's lots of decision points for social workers to jump through. So for example, we're working with the local authority at the moment, and to get food vouchers for families, they have to go through their manager, and their manager has to go through a senior manager. And then I think then it gets authorized. And then there's this massive feedback loop, which takes so much time. So through our work with them, they've just eliminated those processes and said, social workers, here you go. If you need it for a family, this is how you access it. So it may seem quite simple, but these kind of things just get in the way of social workers spending their best times. What we find is that starting small, but also having a clear idea about what is the barrier you're trying to affect, actually helps motivate social workers. It gives them that kind of, I don't know, recognition that they're, number one, being heard, and that change can happen. Because I think sometimes they're just, and we probably know it from our practice, that you can easily become quite disenfranchised with change.
That's so interesting. So Crescendo is like a facilitator. It finds the places where you can manoeuvre, which I think is different from how I'd understood it when we've spoken in the past, which I thought it was you had an idea, but actually you're finding the places where small ideas are needed.
Exactly. So it, in essence, it's facilitative, and it's more about kind of enabling and providing a space. And we're quite honest with ourselves, like, look, it's not rocket science, but where we're having a positive impact is that people are given the space and time to think about this. And there's someone who can come in and create that context for them. So where we start is we start with teams thinking about the question we ask, actually, is what are the values and principles that they want at the heart of children's social care where they work? And we have this real idea of the vision of where we want to be. And then we think about, is that always a lived reality? And if not, what are those barriers that get in the way? And the barriers won't surprise you. It's big, knotty things. But then what we do is we break it down. So if, for example, case recording is an issue, that's an overwhelming kind of issue that we have in the system. But if we really think about kind of looking more in detail at that, what is it about that? So what are the specific kind of things that get in the way? So, for example, we had one kind of system issue where it took, I think, about three different forms to organise transport for a young person. So we looked at with the local authority, why is that in place? Does that need to be in place? No, it doesn't. So we simplified that process through the case management system to make it easier for social workers, thus kind of showing them we can make change, we're listening to you, but also let's try and chip away at giving you back more time.
So you start big, you start with what are our values, what's important, and then you go smaller and smaller with the barriers. That you've already started to give some really lovely concrete examples of where that's worked. And it would be really helpful to maybe hear one or a few more about one of those changes and how it led to positive change for children and family social workers and for the families they support. And were there any barriers to overcome, and what was the end result?
Sure. So I'll give you a few. So, I mean, one simple one that's just on my mind because we covered this last week was with the case management system that one local authority uses, they couldn't copy across notes from siblings and they couldn't open two tabs at one time. And they didn't really understand why. So we were able to kind of connect them with the person who's responsible for that in terms of the tech and just solve that straight away. And the impact that had was that I think one manager told us that the social worker was like, wow, oh my God, I'm being listened to. I've identified a small change and it's happening. I think what we're seeing is that the biggest kind of impact of making these small changes is culturally in terms of value. And interestingly, that's where a lot of the small changes across the three local authorities we're working with, that's where there's a theme in terms of how we feel valued. So to give you another example, two out of the three local authorities have got small changes in terms of thinking about how they celebrate success, or how that kind of leads to positive feedback in terms of how managers or peers communicate with each other that they're doing a good job. So one example always stands out to me, where a social worker said, I'll spend like a day doing this really long court report, and I might get an email back saying approved. And nothing about like, thank you so much for your hard work there. I thought this bit was absolutely brilliant. Thank you for really getting the voice of the child through. Just something so small and so simple, just acknowledging and recognizing the hard work of what people are doing. Now, interestingly, that small change doesn't necessarily relate to creating more time with families. And this is kind of like the exciting bit about our project, because it's led to changes that we were not expecting. So what we've seen with this celebrating success idea is that they're starting to think about new ways of how they give each other positive feedback. So it's things from having a Teams channel where the team kind of identify things that they're proud of that they've seen from their colleagues. Or it might be that, oh, I had a really good chat with Hannah this week and it really made me feel good about myself. So sharing that good news, that appreciative inquiry. We've also had other local authorities have, like, I think tied into World Social Work Day, they had like a tree of success where they use kind of post-its and good examples of good practice. So again, chipping away at this, that in a busy system, we just often do, but we're taking time to really think about kind of the good work that we do day in, day out.
What I'm hearing is that actually the morale of feeling like you can make a difference when you felt swamped, when you felt overwhelmed by the work, is as important as the idea itself.
Exactly. And that's what we didn't expect, because we expected that, because we're in the pilot phase at the moment, that we would start to chip away and kind of make some changes that kind of show that we can do this, we can create more time for you. And we have done that. But then this other impact, like you've said, in terms of like being heard, culture, coming together as a team, really reconnecting with why we want to do social work, that's been really interesting in terms of that impact. In terms of our mission about like time and kind of eliminating these kind of processes that get in the way, there is one which is quite cool. One local authority has decided that they're going to change their approach to meetings. So they work in the early help service as a missing and exploitation team. And they've said, as a team, they are not going to attend meetings in the afternoon. So their kind of vision for how they work is that their afternoons are completely devoted to direct work with adolescents. So obviously that's quite a bold position to take. And we kind of help them think through, like, well, how do you communicate this? Because you don't want to alienate people, alienate partners or social workers that you work alongside. But that's been really interesting, because they've kind of internalized who they are, how they want to be as a team and as a service, and being quite firm in their position. And what we're hoping to see is that could be modeled to other parts of the service. That a meeting is a bugbear of mine. We have so many meetings that don't always seem purposeful. And this team is doing something about it to really increase the amount of time they spend with children and families.
Social workers seem so grateful for the opportunity to move forward, to have hope, to be able to make changes in their own workplace. Beyond your project, what are some of the barriers for social workers in facilitating changes in the sector? And how might we overcome them? If there's a social worker listening today and they want to introduce a new way of doing something, what would you say to them? What tips would you have?
I think one of our key learning points has been what we would do differently would be the roles and responsibilities in making small changes. So what we did was we really kind of prioritised and promoted the social worker voice in terms of making change and identifying change. But social workers are very busy, and we don't want to inadvertently take them away from their work and kind of contradict our values and what we want to get out of this project. So what we've realised is that we could have been clearer on that the social workers are perhaps those who voice what they want to change, but those that lead them, so kind of practice supervisor level, they're the enablers, because they in effect, should have more of a strategic lens. I know that's not always possible with the pressures on the system at the moment, but what we have found where it works is that the kind of social workers or practitioners voice what they need to change, and then the managers, like head of service, service manager, can then be the unblockers, and then that creates that buy-in and that positive feedback loop. We have obviously given the choice for social workers to lead on things if they want to, but what we would do differently is be very clear on the roles and responsibilities. What this means for your question, I suppose, is that I think what I'd encourage social workers to do is think about change on that smaller level. What are those things day in, day out that get in their way that don't need to be there? Are you completing two or three forms when only need to complete one? Are there lots of meetings that don't seem to have a purpose? Are there things about kind of the way you have to work that don't make sense to you, that aren't statutory, that have been created by the system that get in your way? So once you've identified those, I suppose the trick is then, well, what do you do with that? And there is something about, for me, about leadership, because you can't do it on your own, right? So how might you kind of engage your peers about what you've noticed? What, like, why are we doing this? So kind of like, oh, Hannah, have you noticed this as well? And once you have that sense of like community, who might be there who can enable that change? Is it your practice supervisor? It might not be, but is there anyone else in that your practice context that could be someone who sees things how you see things? And could you have a conversation with them? It all starts with these relationships, right? So as social workers, notice what are these things that get in the way, those things that can change, and think about how you can bring in others who might have more influence in the system to achieve those changes on your behalf.
It also creates a workplace that feels really valuable to be in. I think sometimes in practice, these frustrations would manifest as kind of grumbles and feeling and low morale in the workplace, which in itself would be a kind of circular loop. And then that makes you feel low about coming to work. So to feel like I can notice something, but I can go beyond noticing it and talking about it and complaining about it, and we collectively as workers can do something about it, is a really powerful reframe, I think, that I would have so welcomed in practice.
And I think just to think about kind of small changes in terms of how that impacts on children and families, what we've found is that we've got glimmers already, because we're still early days, where actually more time is being spent with children and families. So with the team I spoke about, with the change in their approach to meetings, being more clear in their position and kind of how they communicate that to other agencies, they've now been able to spend more time with children and families in the afternoon. They're able to build those more effective relationships, which is very exciting. But also what we found, because again, I've kind of really hammered home this culture point in terms of why we do what we do, what we've heard from social workers is that, like, yeah, this is what I want to do. It's given them that kind of perspective where they're like, they've been able to take the balcony position and look at their practice and say, oh, actually, I am spending 80% of my time not with children and families. And what could I do to change that in terms of my own ownership and autonomy of my practice? So what we've seen is that, like, people are more committed to kind of really focusing on those relationships and wanting to not only suggest small changes, make small changes, but also they're kind of making that concerted effort to be like, no, I'm going to spend that more time with families. And we're thinking about a project where could we record young people in terms of their voices post a visit? And could we find a way of uploading that? Obviously, navigating data protection, consent, and all those important issues. But could we be a bit more modern, I suppose, with how we record? So can we use kind of videos, voice notes, which, number one, is more in keeping with how young people perhaps might communicate, and they might be more engaged with that. But also it saves time from a practitioner not spending so much time behind a desk writing what they need to write.
What interested me about the conversation with Ryan that I hadn't thought about is the relationship between small changes and staff morale. So we need to feel that we can change the system in order to be motivated in our jobs. Finally, I spoke to Ade Adeniji, who is a certified coach, group facilitator, and organisation consultant. He's worked and supported many social workers with their professional development through Frontlines leadership programmes.
I mean, this happens a lot, actually. The leaders that come from a place of, oh, we've done that before, that will never work. We tried that 10 years ago. That just is not going to work, as opposed to, yeah, we did do something similar, but why don't we give it a shot?
I spoke to Ade about the specific tools needed to drive forward ideas in the social work sector.
I think that the most amazing leaders that I've come across are those leaders who are able to lean into the discomfort of vulnerability. Because change involves uncertainty. There's no guarantee when it comes to change. We don't know what's going to happen. So there might be a restructure within an organization. There might be a legal change and has an impact on people within teams. People don't know how that's going to go. And there are no guarantees. And so those leaders know how to really lean into vulnerability. They know what their own story is around vulnerability. So if a leader feels that they grew up believing that vulnerability was weakness, they need to be very, very conscious of, oh, if I'm going into this situation, I need to just make sure that my own stuff is not getting in the way of this interaction. And tied in with, I think that the most amazing leaders that I come across, the most courageous leaders that I come across, they are self-aware. They know the baggage that they're bringing into the situation, and they stay conscious of when that baggage is maybe contaminating the process. So I think those are the kind of leaders that I really, really admire. The people who are able to go, ooh, this is a stretch for me. This is a challenge for me. And they go in confronting that. The other piece to that, which Brené Brown talks about in her work, is around the wholehearted self. So she's a researcher at the University of Houston in Texas, who's done a lot of work around vulnerability, courage, shame, and wholehearted management, leadership, and living, which involves thinking, feeling, and doing. So the most amazing leaders that I've come across are able to navigate all three. I think very often I come across leaders who are very good at the thinking and very good at the doing, but not so great when it comes to the feeling. And we kind of see that in many sectors, actually. Let's just do, let's just deliver. But when it comes to, well, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that change? How do you feel about what just happened? Do we really have to talk about that? I don't want to talk about that. And then we come back to that vulnerability piece that I was talking about earlier on.
That's such an important point. Yourself and Brené Brown and some other people's work enables us to see how important self-reflexivity, vulnerability is in leadership. As social workers, we're busy with so many competing priorities, so many risks to manage, so much work to do. Why do you think we should give time to our own career development and professional learning?
Yeah, I mean, we are constantly evolving. No one is fixed. No one is set. No one arrives as a finished product. No one has all the answers. We are constantly changing. Organizations are constantly changing. Systems are constantly changing. And I do believe that the more each of us does our own inner work, the more we're able to show up from a place of authenticity, from a place of congruence, and from a place of integration. So I really admire leaders who come into situations from a place of curiosity. They go, oh, actually, I don't have all the answers. You know, they come from a place of wanting to be a learner as opposed to a knower. And I think that is really, really crucial because no one has all the answers. And I think that humility piece kind of ties in there. If leaders are coming from a place of, I want to go into this situation to learn so that I can start to develop my team even more and get them to a place of excellence, as opposed to coming into a place of, oh, I have all the answers. This happens a lot, actually. The leaders that come from a place of, oh, we've done that before, that will never work. We tried that 10 years ago. That just is not going to work. As opposed to, yeah, we did do something similar, but why don't we give it a shot and let's see what happens. So the curiosity goes with that learning.
Yes, the idea of curiosity. And when I think there's a relationship between cynicism and lack of curiosity, when you feel like, oh, there's nothing we can do, then that's a kind of sign. It's a sign of social workers working with families. When you start to feel cynical, it's a sign that you've lost your curiosity.
It is. As opposed to thinking, this is a new family that's in front of me right now. This is a different child that's in front of me. Yes, their story is similar-ish to that case I dealt with X number of months ago, but this is a new person with a new story, with a new sort of way of navigating the world. So how can we approach that from a place of curiosity?
And I guess it links to busyness in the role. And I think when I think back to how I felt in practice, when we can feel overwhelmed by the amount we have to do in our roles, sometimes that makes me feel like we've got a misalignment with our values, but that it's selfish to do anything about it, to take stock, to focus on our own needs and learning needs when the job at hand just takes so much time. How do we grapple with that problem?
Yeah. I mean, self-care is so, so important. And self-care does not mean selfishness. That is really important to know. I mean, I know people use this example all the time, and I'm going to use it. And it's an example of being on a flight, and they say, put your own oxygen mask on first before you put it on to the people that you have caring responsibilities for. That is so, so important. You know, if leaders are not resourced within themselves, they're not resourced to help people within their teams, they're not resourced to help those children and families. So that is really, really important to recognize that there is a huge difference between selfish and self-care. And this is where self-compassion comes in. I think these leaders need to, like all of us actually, start to practice that self-compassion so that we know that we're giving something to ourselves so that we can show up fully from a place of engagement and connection.
Thinking about when you have your one-on-one sessions with social workers, what are the common barriers and challenges you observe in stopping them trying new ways of doing things, whatever that might be? And on the back of that, the ways in which we might overcome them.
I think a big one that I come across is that fear and anxiety of being true to themselves. Like, how can I be authentic when I go into these situations? And that sort of comes forth more with people who are starting to move up the ladder. So at the social worker level, the kind of cases that I come across is, how can I juggle it all? How can I juggle? Because there's so much more to being a social worker than just sitting down with a family. There's much more that goes with it. So how can I juggle all those priorities? And then when I start working with people who are sort of maybe a couple of levels up, they talk about, how can I be authentic? How can I be true to my values without letting my fear get in the way? And imposter syndrome is something that comes up a lot, actually, in the work that I do, where people feel that I have to perform, I have to act to be, quote marks, this professional person, as opposed to being this authentic individual. So that imposter syndrome comes up higher up the levels, and at the lower levels, there's something there around just not knowing how to juggle, how to prioritize, which I really feel comes back to that values piece that I was talking about. People need to be really clear around, what are my values and why are those values important to me? And in those moments where I'm not in alignment with those values, what do I need to do in order to get back into alignment?
Just also wondering, is professional development as important for social workers early in their careers? So I'm thinking back to my early years in practice, and you know, I had so many ideas, but I was also grappling with the role. How do social workers see themselves as leaders and change facilitators right from the get-go?
Yeah. In fact, I just did a program for newly qualified social workers, and we took them through the Brené Brown research. We took them through all those four skill sets. And the feedback we got from the majority of the people in the group was, it's so great to have the opportunity to look at these skill sets at such an early stage, because many of them were caught up with, what does it mean to be a good social worker? How do we serve the needs of families and children? And many of them were saying things like, when it comes to, and I hate this phrase, the soft skills, when it comes to that soft skills element, that many of them felt like there were just so many gaps that they hadn't really covered. So I would actually say it's not just professional development, it's personal development as well. You know, navigating vulnerability is something that we get to do in our personal and professional lives. Living into our values, it ties in with our personal and professional lives. You know, navigating trust, personal and professional lives, learning to rise is our personal and professional lives as well. So I think It is important, not just from a professional perspective, but from a personal perspective as well. The other thing that I really do believe is that the more we practice these skills in our personal lives, the more equipped we become in practicing them in our professional lives as well. So if I'm not doing anything around vulnerability in my personal life, it becomes really, really difficult when it comes to work environment to lean into that. And that's where that imposter syndrome that I talked about earlier on starts to come in, where someone might feel, ooh, I am performing in my role as opposed to being in my role, because I'm not really doing those things in other aspects of my life. That holistic perspective is really, really important, because we just start to show up as wholehearted human beings where we are conscious of our thoughts, our feelings, and our behaviors as well, and being congruent with them as well. So people are not just acting in a particular way when they go into their social work function. They're acting as themselves whilst being mindful of the guiding principles of what it means to be a social worker.
What I loved about my conversation with Ade was his conception of leadership needing to be vulnerable. This isn't always championed in social work, and personally, I found this point really valuable. It was great to hear from social workers in different roles and working within different local authorities talk about how committed they are to positive change in the sector and the ways in which they're implementing small but significant changes. I really hope this will help you to take those small steps, navigate those barriers, and spark the change you want to see for children and families. That's all for me. Look forward to sharing our next conversation with you soon. And don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. I'll see you next time.